From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is.
This is.
This is.
This is War News Radio.
I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Colin Smith.
This week on War News Radio, Unlikely Connections, we first hear from a physics professor about a formula he's developed in studying insurgent attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Then we hear about a lifelong anti-war protester who is finding new inspiration in the Occupy Wall Street protests.
Finally, we investigate rape as a weapon of war in Libya.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraq is asking that the United States leave 5,000 military trainers after the scheduled withdrawal of U.S. forces at the end of this year. Iraqi officials are refusing to grant the American trainers immunity from prosecution, citing numerous examples where the U.S. military has failed to prosecute American soldiers who have killed Iraqis. The U.S. has always said that immunity was a prerequisite for allowing their troops to remain in Iraq, but the current request by Iraq seems to indicate that they are refusing to negotiate, asking for the U.S. to either agree to or reject the proposal.
The United Nations reports that opium production in Afghanistan has increased by 61% compared to last year, reversing the progress made by anti-drug efforts over the previous 3 years. In addition, the nation's total opium crops value doubled to $1.4 billion, though street value brought in far greater profits. The surge comes as the demand for opium has risen, and security surrounding the crop become lower. Analysts say that the organizers of the opium production are not just insurgents, but Afghan power brokers, warlords, military commanders, and politicians as well. According to the UN, opium profits account for approximately 9% of the country's gross domestic product, with about 10% of the profits going directly to the Taliban.
A recent United Nations report reveals systematic torture in prisons detaining suspected insurgents in Afghanistan. The report, citing interviews with 300 detainees, collected examples of multiple abuses, including beatings and electrical shocks. The report indicates that the use of torture was not part of typical Afghan policy, but was rather the decision of individual jailers, and it does not assess whether United States officials knew anything of these activities. However, the discovery makes it uncertain whether the U.S. can legally continue to fund Afghan security forces, which was an important aspect of the military withdrawal plan. NATO has since discontinued the transfer of detained insurgents to these prison centers, creating a logistical problem for Western forces fearing continued abuses. This is War News Radio. American troops have been battling insurgents for much of the last decade, but the conflicts can feel far removed from life at home. War News Radio's Aileen Eisenberg has been talking to a researcher who is trying to reduce insurgent attacks and who says you can help too.
Professor Neil Johnson never imagined that he would be applying physics and math to the study of insurgent warfare.
It's certainly something that you'd want to be aware of. I think certainly if I was going out to any kind of conflict, and I'd like to know about this.
According to the United States Department of Defense, more than 6,000 troops have been killed and 45,000 wounded during the current wars against insurgent forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. Johnson is a physics professor at the University of Miami and says that he has found a formula that can help predict insurgent attacks and save lives.
The interest to me was really to do with the numbers that we all hear every night, that those numbers, as they tend to seemed to me, just looking every night, seemed kind of random. We were trying to see if there was some pattern to the numbers.
To research these attacks, Johnson looked at records from both Afghanistan and Iraq to understand insurgency. Johnson's formula examines data from one particular province to predict when the next attack will occur in that area, taking into account both the amount of attacks that have already occurred and the escalation rate for that particular province.
Basically, the formula breaks down into the time between the nth and the nth plus one event is given by the time between the first two events multiplied by the number of the event, the N, to the power of negative some negative number. That negative number is the escalation rate.
In other words, if two attacks happen in the same province, Johnson takes the time between those two incidents and plugs it into the equation along with the escalation rate of attacks in the province. This equation then gives an estimate of the number of days until the next predicted attack in this province. According to Johnson, on a given day, there is at most one fatal attack per province. Johnson will consider any given attack from any weapon so long as it's fatal. In limiting the equations to just one type of weapon, a pattern emerges. The patterns that emerge from this formula show that the way in which the attacks increased in frequency was based off of a learning curve for human progress. The time that it takes insurgents to learn and improve their methods is similar to learning nonviolent tasks, such as riding a bike. There is, however, a slight complication in that insurgent learning curves balance both the progress of insurgents and that of the opposition.
Yeah, there's a subtle twist. There's a subtle twist that when you ride a bike, the bike isn't doing anything to stop you from riding it. I mean, it may be wobbly, but it's wobbly. It's always wobbly in the same way. It's not trying to out-wobble you.
Fighting insurgency, however, is more complicated. Because the military is attempting to prevent insurgents from improving their ability to kill, the insurgents face a more difficult learning curve. Both sides create a co-competing learning environment. Because the formula takes into account both the insurgents and the military opposition, military officials can use it to understand which side is succeeding. In examining which provinces in Afghanistan and Iraq contain insurgents who are experiencing either rapid or stagnated learning curves, military officers will be able to determine which methods are effective in counterinsurgency. The Defense Department is currently building schools and having military troops interact with locals in provinces. If these tactics succeed, we will see less frequent attacks. What's more, the formula is informative even when it fails to predict the next attack. When such a change occurs, interpreters of the formula can infer that either side has done something to change the situation.
Things don't happen that way. It's because red side or the blue side, but of course blue side knows what they've done, but then we can infer the red side have done something.
Johnson argues that we can learn both where things are headed and, in the case when attacks deviate from the formula, when things have changed. And when the formula is incorrect, interpreters can then go and examine what might have changed.
It's like a weather report in that sense.
Researching with University of Miami undergraduates skilled in political science, biology, and mathematics, Johnson believes that working with students from different areas of academia showed that disciplines can overcome their boundaries and contribute to a larger concept. Johnson's interdisciplinary formula informs military officials of insurgents' abilities, regardless of accurately predicting the next attack.
We produced something that was kind of bigger than the individual parts. I absolutely think that certainly taught me, and I hope it's shown other people, what can be contributed across the boundaries of disciplines in the field of conflict and war studies and help for the U.S.
Although he has already published papers in regards to this formula, Johnson now looks to examine how these factors are affecting the learning curves. Spencer Curran, a senior biology and applied math major at the University of Miami, worked with Johnson on this research. Curran attested to the comprehensiveness of combining academia and conflict studies.
There were a lot of nights where I'd be up 1 or 2 in the morning emailing back and forth with Dr. Johnson about something we were working on in relation to the paper. We've been going at this nonstop for about almost a year and a half now.
Curran and Johnson have placed a lot of effort into their research because their work is extremely relevant. According to the International Security Assistance Force, insurgent attacks have grown by 20% or more each year in Afghanistan since 2006. It's undeniable that insurgency is on the rise and that the United States must examine the way in which it can battle such attacks if it plans to maintain deployment in these regions. Without signs of their research tapering off in the near future, Johnson and his group recognize the importance of including academia into conflict studies. Johnson notes that because the United States has a finite defense budget, it is impossible to put everyone, everywhere, all of the time. Such a formula can help determine which resources should go to which provinces. Although this formula is far from perfect, Johnson argued that the insight it can provide fuels the need for further research. The ability to enter a conflict with any concept of what one will be facing is what drives counterinsurgency research, especially since these attacks are not, in fact, random.
That kind of insight, particularly in terms for the U.S. policy in the future, could help.
Though the formula may remind you of Numbers, a television program based on solving crime through mathematical reasoning, Johnson is clear to point out that conflict is not quite as idealistic as a television program.
House is to medicine as Numbers is to this. You know, we would love it to be as neat as that. It's like a never-ending Numbers episode.
For Johnson, this formula shows the importance of individual perspectives and contributions.
I would encourage anyone that has any good ideas, who looks at the numbers in the newspapers, hears the numbers on the news, you get a sense that somebody must be working on it and they must have worked it all out. Well, that's not the case, and it's not that there aren't bright people looking at things. It's just that, you know, every person looking at it can contribute something, and it might even be new.
Johnson's formula is only the start of academia's involvement in conflict studies. As the insurgents experience this learning curve, U.S. military officials must begin to counteract them. Perhaps the formula will not predict every future insurgency attack, but it has opened the discussion to studying insurgents. For War News Radio, I'm Aileen Eisenberg.
This is War News Radio. As the American war in Afghanistan turns 10 years old this month, now longer than World Wars I and II combined, the Occupy Wall Street movement is putting domestic demonstrations back on the map. But how are they related? War News Radio's Jim McMillan dropped in on one lifelong activist who feels the connection.
If you've ever traveled along Broad Street just north of Philadelphia City Hall, you might have spotted them standing there, along the narrow median strip. A small band of demonstrators, mostly silver-haired women, asking you to honk your horn.
Oh, I sort of leave here deaf sometimes.
That's Celeste Zapala, and she doesn't want you to forget about the wars.
We, as a little group, have signs that say, honk for peace, honk to end the wars, and support our troops, bring them home now.
The first part of her plan is working, and the discordant din blares along the block for an hour, but Zapala thinks it does much more.
Even if it's, you know, a two-second honk, it's 2 seconds of solidarity. It's 2 seconds of consciousness raising. It's just a way to remind people that there are wars going on in their name.
Now, 10 years after the United States first waged war in Afghanistan, there's a lot of honking. Zapala says the nation has been following a frightening path, but she is driven by personal reasons as well.
My son, Sergeant Sherwood Baker, was killed in Iraq on April the 26th, 2004. And I knew before he went that the war was wrong. I wasn't loud enough.
Baker was the first Pennsylvania National Guard soldier to be killed in action since 1945.
When he was killed, my family and I made a decision that we would speak out.
After college, Baker worked as a nursery school teacher and a social worker, caring for mentally handicapped adults, even helping one couple to get married. Zapala describes her son as someone who wouldn't let you stay sad if he was around, that loved kids and drew people to him.
Musical, he was a disc jockey, he was a funny guy.
And Zapala says Baker was the kind of guy you could count on.
If you were in trouble and you decide you had three people to call, he'd be one of the people you'd want to call to help you out.
Baker was a big guy, too, and he answered that sort of call in 1996 to fill sandbags as the Susquehanna River was threatening to flood Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where he was living at the time. He found himself working side by side with National Guard soldiers and later told his mother that he liked the guys.
And in 1997, when he joined the National Guard, they promised that they would clear up his student loans, and he would have all this extra money, and he could get his house.
Zapala was concerned, like the mother of any soldier, but her son reassured her that the National Guard didn't go to war. He told her that they just helped out at disasters.
And what's the worst that could happen, Mom? Maybe I'd have to arrest you and Daddy at a demonstration.
Zapala has been a lifelong anti-war demonstrator.
Celeste was born an activist.
That's Zapala's lifetime friend, Ann Ewing. They've been fighting for peace together for decades, going back to the Vietnam era.
The Vietnam War was pointless, a waste of life.
Then, in 2003, with American wars underway in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Pennsylvania Guard was called to active duty for the first time since World War II.
Well, he was conflicted, but he said, you know, I've taken an oath before God, and I will go and do my duty and bring myself and my men home safely.
Zapala says Baker's unit was on a mission providing security for the Iraq Survey Group, which was still looking for weapons of mass destruction.
It was some kind of explosion in a factory building. Don't know what it was, really, never did learn. And he was killed.
As soon as they got the news, Zapala says her family sensed a turning point.
I knew that night, his father knew it, brothers knew it, we were not going to be quiet. This was wrong. And I wasn't going to let anybody co-opt his death and wrap their flags around it and call it right.
Behind her glasses, tears are welling in this bereaved mother's eyes one more time, but she grabs every chance to engage those passing by. Another mom, with a son in Iraq, stops to commiserate over the treatment of soldiers, but defends the mission. A homeless Vietnam veteran walks up and asks Zapala for help, and she hands him a little cash, asking only that he spend it on food. He lashes out as he walks away.
We're not drug addicts. We were betrayed.
Ewing says that these encounters are not unusual, but that her friend handles rejection well.
Well, Celeste's persistence is staggering. There are people here who, you know, will give you the finger and that sort of thing. Her grace in the face of that is always a lesson.
But looking forward, Zapala admits that she has not been feeling hopeful for a while.
You know, in a lot of ways, I see, you know, a great nation that's crumbling under the weight of its own greed and bad decisions. And it's frightening to me.
She seems concerned in particular with the generation now entering the workforce at the same point in life as her son when he first joined the Guard.
I see that many young people finish college with enormous loans and they can't find a job. The best they can do is Starbucks.
Yet, Zapala laments, she has seldom found much youthful support in resistance to the wars.
Kind of sick at heart that it's all old people, it's Vietnam vets, it's parents of military.
She was feeling just as discouraged 6 years ago when she happened upon a man with his 9-year-old son who were protesting alone on the same spot. Zapala and her friends have been standing with him ever since.
There are always at least 3 of us, sometimes as many as 30 of us. We've been here through blizzards, rain, and heat.
Jeff Harland was fearing for the life of his brother, who was in the military and had just been deployed to Kuwait. He conceived of this Final Friday protest, held on the last Friday of each month, and finds encouragement in Zapala's support.
Oh, her work is so inspiring. I mean, I was honored that she wanted to come out here and stand with me.
Now, much as when she first found Harland, Zapala is suddenly finding new inspiration in the faces of the recent Occupy Wall Street protesters.
I'm very excited about what's going on in New York. Energized by the fact that there are people there who don't have gray hair.
For Zapala, this new wave of activism may have come just in time.
Just a month ago, I thought, I can't do this anymore. I got to give it up. I can't. This is hopeless. And then there it is. There's those kids in New York City, like the kids who went out in Egypt and Tunisia and decided that they were just going to go for it. And that gives me great hope.
Since Zapala and her friends began meeting here on Broad Street, the Army closed a recruiting center at the other end of the block. But as the wars linger on, this group has no plan to leave.
People can count on us being here and in this very visible, very busy place, give people a chance to express their opinion.
As the hour draws down, sirens wail along the block as police cars escort buses from a nearby university, apparently transporting the football team, and Zapala exits laughing at the collective priorities.
I think I've never had a police escort to go someplace. I've had police escorts to leave.
More protests called Occupy Together have now taken hold in dozens of U.S. cities. Celeste Zapala has already joined them at Philadelphia City Hall, as well as on Wall Street and in Washington, D.C., but still plans to return to the corner of Arch Street and North Broad for the next Final Friday on October 28th. For War News Radio, I'm Jim McMillan.
This is War News Radio. During the peak of the conflict in Libya, we heard many stories concerning Colonel Muammar Gaddafi using rape as a weapon in war. War News Radio's Anushka Mehta spoke with a few experts, including a couple who recently returned from the war zone in Libya.
Nearly 8 months after the first protests began in Libya, the rebels now have control of the capital, Tripoli. The hunt for Muammar Gaddafi continues as he remains missing and fighting continues in the capital.
The issues of women's rights globally and defending the rights of women's human rights defenders were near and dear to what I really think is very primary and important for women around the globe.
That was Rachel Vincent, who has had a long career working in communication for nonprofits and has been working at the Nobel Women's Initiative for the past 3 years. Rape is a timeless tragedy and will continue to occur in war zones, but there are ways for us to intervene. In recent months, stories have been pouring in from news organizations such as CNN and the Daily Mail regarding the increasing use of rape as a form of subjugation by Gaddafi forces. Charlene Gubosh is an NBC News producer based in Egypt.
There was a sociologist who actually interviewed women, and her work is the most noted on the subject, and she said that at least 300 women were raped in eastern Libya.
Gubosh says there was a case where four Italian journalists were kidnapped. Among them were two women who feared they would be raped when their kidnappers handed them condoms.
But they were rescued before that happened.
NBC News correspondent Stephanie Gosk says that you have to be very careful because both sides had a tendency to lie.
You also have to realize that in this war, there has been quite a bit of propaganda on both sides. And we don't really have a good idea of how many women were raped and under what circumstances.
Gosk says that Libyan rebels alleged that Gaddafi forces were raping women.
Gaddafi was providing them with Viagra to rape as many women as possible. There was never any real proof provided for that allegation. I think there certainly was rape used. We just don't know on what scale.
Although the issue of rape during the war got a lot of media coverage by CNN, the Daily Mail, and other news organizations, it is not a new tactic. Stephanie Gosk says it is a terrible tool of war.
Certainly, you read about it in the history books. There's that phrase, rape and pillage, that's been around for a long time.
Vincent similarly discusses how rape has long since been used during war. However, she also adds that there is a key difference between previous instances of rape in war and current ones.
At other times, it's been a byproduct of war. Now it's increasingly used as a tactic of war.
According to Gubosh, there was a woman on Free Libya TV talking about being raped by Gaddafi himself, giving us an example of rape being used deliberately as a weapon in war.
Rape seemed to be almost institutionalized on the upper echelon. They would have blood tests done, and then he would rape them.
Gosk adds,
it's a Muslim country, and in many Muslim countries, women have a subservient role, and that's the case in Libya as well. Interestingly, under Gaddafi, he seemed to want women around him as his security guards and gave them a certain level of empowerment, made them more sex symbols than actual partners.
Rape is definitely an extremely effective tool in war. Vincent says it is used to
deliberately humiliate communities, to tear the very fabric of those communities apart. The ramifications are very long-lasting, much longer-lasting, I would argue, than traditional weapons, in the sense that the relationships in the community are damaged for generations possibly to come.
Gubosh reports that a woman found out that Gaddafi wanted to rape her, so she left to another region in Libya, and her brother was arrested, and she was informed that if she didn't come back, her brother would be killed. So she came back and was raped.
They gave her a hysterectomy after that, and then she was forced to work as a housekeeper in his house.
Ghoubash says that although women are oppressed in Libya, they are very optimistic about the future of Libya due to the positive role they played during the war.
There were women upstairs who were cooking these meals, and they had to cook like 3 meals a day to be sent out all across Libya for the rebels in the field. So they sent me a message saying, in English, in perfect English, saying, come but don't bring anyone with you.
Ghoubash says they were thrilled to be able to talk to someone and get their message out.
And their message out was that this revolution was nothing but good for women, and that they thought that this would really promote their position in society.
Rape and gender violence affects a huge percentage of the population.
1 in 3 women, according to the UN Secretary General, are impacted by rape or other forms of gender violence. It's common to probably all countries in the world, some more than others, but it's an experience that I think all women around the world, indeed all people, should and can relate to.
According to Vincent, many people have to leave their countries. They lose children and relationships after being rejected by their communities due to sexual violence over which they had no say.
The reach of this problem is very, very extensive.
Due to the large distribution of this issue, some journalists are more pessimistic about the extent to which females will be involved with Libya's future.
There aren't many women that are involved in the interim council that's now in control of the country.
Goss continues that although there were strong female voices when the uprising began, the country is now seeing more conservative Muslim elements coming into play.
Well, the most important thing for women in Libya is for them to have a voice and to step up and participate in society. I don't see that same kind of strength amongst the female population in this particular uprising. When you deal with issues of rape, the empowerment of women in society in general is really at the bottom of it.
Reuters reports that Libya's National Transition Council has outlined steps so that the UN can monitor democratic elections within 18 months. When the elections take place, we will be able to see how the role of women and their protection in society may or may not change. Vincent believes that the best way to help out is to inform yourselves.
There are many amazing resources online, even our website.
She adds that the next step is to start voicing your concerns at a local political level, asking for your community leaders to address this issue. For War News Radio, I'm Anushka Mehta.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Colin Smith.
And I'm Eliana Biscard-Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.